This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKinney. Mourners converged in Minneapolis, Minnesota Thursday to memorialize George Floyd, whose death at the hands of a police officer has sparked international protest on racial justice. Hollywood celebrities, civil rights leaders, musicians, and politicians gathered in front of the golden casket of Floyd Thursday for the first in a series of memorials for the man who was anonymous in life but sparked global protests for justice in his death. During the eulogy, the Reverend Al Sharpton said that Floyd should not be among the deceased but had been victimized by an unjust treatment of African Americans. The 46-year-old Floyd died May 25th after a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, put his knee on Floyd's neck for several minutes as he lay handcuffed on the pavement. Chauvin has been charged with second-degree murder. He and three other officers could get up to 40 years in prison. As protesters descended on Capitol Hill, lawmakers worked on what could become one of the most ambitious efforts in years to oversee how law enforcement works. Both the U.S. Senate and House are expected to include proposed changes to police accountability laws and training requirements addressing the loss of trust between police departments and communities they serve. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she'll leave it to the Congressional Black Caucus to give details. Defense attorneys say two of three Minneapolis police officers charged with aiding and abetting in the death of George Floyd were rookies, barely off probation when a more senior white officer ignored the black man's cries for help and pressed the knee to his neck. The attorney, Earl Gray, says former officer Thomas Lane had no choice but to follow instructions of Derek Chauvin, who has since been charged with second-degree murder in Floyd's May 25th death. Gray calls the case against his client extremely weak. A judge Thursday set bail for $750,000 for the three officers. This is VOA News. Days after his boss received criticism for what some of his opponents have called a publicity stunt, U.S. Attorney General William Barr defended President Trump by saying there was no correlation between law enforcement dispersing protesters from Lafayette Square near the White House on Monday and President Trump's walk to nearby St. John's Church shortly thereafter. A visit, he said, was entirely appropriate. Barr said the country is dealing up with the witch's brew. He ordered law enforcement to expand their perimeter another block away from the White House Monday evening. He denied that the path was cleared of activists demonstrating against police brutality to make way for Mr. Trump's trip to the church. Barr joined Mr. Trump at the church later. In China, there's a group of protests that continues on its own. The second largest economy continues to grapple with its set of issues where protesters have been arrested after thousands defied a ban to stage candlelight rallies in memory of the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. Reuters witnesses said that scuffles briefly broke out in Mong Kok, where hundreds had gathered and some demonstrators tried to set up roadblocks with metal barriers, prompting officers to use pepper spray. The annual vigil in Hong Kong was banned by police this year, citing the coronavirus. Officials have repeatedly said a ban on groups larger than eight is a public health measure with no political motivation. The anniversary has struck an especially sensitive nerve in Hong Kong this year after China's move last month to impose national security legislation and passage of a bill outlawing disrespect of China's national anthem on Thursday. More than 391,000 people have died from COVID-19 globally. That figure is more than 108,000 in the United States. There are more than 6.6 million confirmed infections worldwide and more than 1.8 million in the U.S. The number of Americans filing for new unemployment benefits dipped below 2 million for the first time since mid-March. The Labor Department announced Thursday that new jobless claims hit 1.8 million last week. That's a big drop from nearly 7 million Americans filing for first-time benefits when much of the economy was forced to shut down over health concerns. But economists say that jobless numbers remain stubbornly high and reflect a second yet smaller wave of layoffs by companies struggling to cope with a weak demand. The jobless numbers also likely reflect states playing catch-up by finally processing claims for those workers displaced at the onset of the shutdown. More businesses have been allowed to reopen their doors, though, and many Americans are starting to return to work. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 5th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The United States and Africa fight a multi-front battle against coronavirus.
Our primary concerns in Africa now are responding to the disease, the food security issues and disruptions in access to food, economic and employment impacts in Africa, and concerns for democratic backsliding.
Uganda's government promises help for businesses most affected by the COVID-19 lockdown. International students stranded by COVID-19 in Kenya plead for help. A fresh outbreak of Ebola kills 4 in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And a South Sudan unity government official resigns.
I am not resigning from the SPLM, SPLA-IO as a political movement. It's only the so-called unity government, which I don't believe is doing what it's supposed to be doing. And so that's why I'm resigning from that.
Captain Mabio Garande Mabio, South Sudan, and Guinea's opposition parties are planning a protest against changes to the country's constitution. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The challenges faced by African nations during the coronavirus pandemic are about much more than a rapidly spreading virus, according to American aid officials. They are concerned about the threats it poses to proper nutrition, the economy, liberties and freedoms, and the ongoing war against a deadly parasite that has plagued Africa for centuries, malaria. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The U.S. has put in more than $1 billion towards helping other countries fight the coronavirus pandemic. By State Department estimates, more than a quarter of that money has gone to the African continent. And in 2019, the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department added another $8.3 billion of assistance to 47 countries. That may seem like a large sum, but USAID's Senior Coordinator for Africa, Christopher Runyon, enumerated the challenges they have to cover with those funds, especially amid predictions that a viral spike is on its way for African nations.
Our primary concerns in Africa now are responding to the disease, the food security issues and disruptions in access to food, economic and employment impacts in Africa, and concerns for democratic backsliding and the loss of progress in other development sectors. On health response, we may not yet have seen the potential height of an outbreak in sub-Saharan Africa. Weak health system capacity, urban density with poor sanitation, and other challenges make Africa particularly vulnerable to a large-scale outbreak.
And says Dr. Kenneth Staley, USAID's global malaria coordinator and leader of its COVID-19 task force, there is another killer on the loose. According to the World Health Organization, malaria kills about 400,000 Africans each year. He says health workers and officials are doing all they can to keep up the fight against malaria.
We're trying to ensure that all of our services are maintained during this time. As with many other crises, the challenges we see are very similar. So first of all, we see effects with our supply chains. We need to spend more time and think more about how we can get active pharmaceutical ingredients, for example, all the way to making sure that our medicines can reach the last mile. Then the third point, in terms of quantifying impact, we've seen about a 25 to 30% increase in our costs. To put a price tag on it, our estimated increased costs at the moment are about $120 million. And so I think the malaria coordinators in each country, as well as international partners, are going to great lengths to think through how we can adapt our delivery of care in the COVID-19 environment.
So far, the virus has killed about 2,800 people in Africa, according to WHO reports. In the U.S., 105,000 people have died. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says his government will provide liquidity to private firms most affected by the COVID-19 lockdown. He says his government will invest more in agriculture to overcome the negative effects of the coronavirus pandemic. Mugume Davis Rakarinji reports from Kampala.
In his State of the Nation address Thursday afternoon, President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni said, despite the lockdown introduced to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus pandemic, Uganda has been able to earn foreign exchange by exporting agriculture products. For example, Uganda exported coffee worth $45 million and $36 million for the month of March and April respectively.
Maize, in March, it brought in $10 million. In April, $6 million. Our agriculture is therefore not only feeding us almost 100%, but also earning dollars for us of the magnitude of $2 billion a year.
Mr. Museven said his government will with immediate effect inject 300 billion Uganda shillings, or about $80 million into agriculture-related activities. He however said the country has lost millions of revenues from what he called vulnerable economy, such as from tourism and entertainment. Mr. Museven said the government will avail some 1 trillion Uganda shillings, or about $266 million for sectors hard hit by over 70 days of the lockdown.
Those affected include the border riders, the saloon operators, the bars people, the nightclub people, the artists, etc. These funds can be used at low interest for these categories of our people to possibly do other activities.
Other measures to help businesses will include allowing extension of payment periods and waiver of interest on some taxes.
The government will not allow the landlords evicting tenants on account of not paying rent. Discussions have started with both groups and a solution will be found.
Overall, Mr. Museven said the lockdown has helped the country to accelerate manufacturing and reduce dependency on imports. For example, factories manufacturing sanitizers have increased from 2 before the lockdown to over 100. Some factories are also involved in manufacturing of personal protection equipment. President Museven said some of this funding will be obtained through foreign direct investments from China and India. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
A number of international students stranded in Kenya due to the closure of borders and schools because of the COVID-19 pandemic say they are unable to afford basic needs. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has asked a committee formed to look into schools reopening to speed up its report.
Nearly 3 months since schools closed, most international students in Kenya were caught off guard, and most of them could not travel back to their countries after Kenya banned international flights in and out of the country, as well as public transport. Tom Malou, the president of South Sudanese Students Association in Kenya, said that most of the international students are stranded in the universities they study in, since most of them reside within the school. Malou, who studies at St. Paul's University in Nairobi, said that the efforts of the association to reach out to the South Sudanese government to salvage their situation did not bear fruits.
There are some students who are just stranded in hostels. Some could not even afford the basic need. So far, we are facing a lot of challenges as international students. We have tried to reach our government on how to deal with these challenges which are actually being faced by the students who are studying in Kenya and Uganda. The reply was that the students who are in Kenya were self-sponsored students. Therefore, they have to be looked after by their parents and the guardians who brought them to school here, which was very unfortunate.
Many international students are hoping that Kenya might ease some of its restrictions so they can travel back home. John Zagabe, a Democratic Republic of Congo national, is an international student leader at Kenyatta University in Nairobi, stranded in students' quarters. He says back at home, his native hometown is on a total lockdown and that he cannot receive any help from home.
There's a very big challenge in that side of upkeep. Back home, like where I'm staying in DRC, there's in my town right now, there's a total lockdown. The banks have closed, and so with time, we might wish to travel back home soon, very soon, and to avoid all these things of lacking what to eat or lacking money to pay rent.
However, President Uhuru Kenyatta has asked the committee which was formed to look into measures to be undertaken in case Kenya decides to reopen schools to fasten the process.
The anxiety that is weighing heavily on the minds of parents and children, particularly those preparing for the national exams, and I share the heavy hearts. I am hereby directing that the Ministry of Education fast tracks and finalizes the ongoing consultations with all stakeholders that will provide us with an appropriate calendar for the gradual resumption of education in the country.
All eyes are now on President Uhuru Kenyatta's Saturday State of the Nation address speech on whether he will ease some restrictions to enable Kenyans continue with business as usual. The Minister of Health announced that the government hospitals are congested as COVID-19 cases increase. Yesterday, Thursday, Kenya recorded 124 COVID-19 cases, bringing the total number to 2,340 as four more patients succumbed to the virus, raising the number of deaths to 78. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, June 5th. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, says four people have died in a fresh outbreak of Ebola in the Northwestern Democratic Republic of Congo, with one case yet to be confirmed. It is the country's second current outbreak of the deadly virus, with one in the east that has dragged on for more than a year and a half, as health officials also deal with a major measles problem and the COVID-19 pandemic. Mavis Ochery reports from Accra, Ghana.
The new outbreak occurred in Bandaka, the capital of Equatorial Province, in the northwestern part of the country. Four additional people who contracted the virus, including a 15-year-old girl, are being treated in an isolation unit. Frank Abiel, UNICEF DRC Ebola coordinator, says it's not clear yet if this is a new outbreak. Equatorial experienced a short outbreak in 2018, during which 33 people died and 54 were infected. It was not as difficult to bring under control as one in the east, where conflict and mistrust of the government hampered health workers' efforts. Abiel says currently there will be no particular reason for the disease resurfacing after 2 years unless the area is prone to Ebola.
It's difficult to say because we don't know exactly how many people have been affected, but from the current observation, according to people affected, we assume so far that 60%, which is huge, under 18, have been affected. But once again, we have to be very cautious because we do not yet have all the figures of the current outbreak.
Abiel says UNICEF will also continue to provide psychosocial support to families, including children affected by the disease, and to make water, hygiene and sanitation available in community schools and health centers.
UNICEF is one of the major partners of the government in responding to such kind of outbreak. We are mainly involved in community engagement and mass communication and risk communication towards populations and support people in understanding the disease.
He says UNICEF has deployed 36 staff to work with communities, psychologists, psychosocial workers, and non-governmental organizations to assist those infected and affected by Ebola and to raise awareness to maintain good hygiene and behavioral practices to prevent the spread of the disease. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Ochery in Ghana.
It appears peace in South Sudan under the revitalized transition and government of national unity is threading on a rocky roll. Last week, the Minister for Peace, Stephen Paul Kuo, a member of Riek Machar's former rebel SPLM-IO, told VOA that the peace process was encountering obstacles, including the unity government's deadlock on power sharing at the state level. Now, a member of the unity government, also from Riek Machar's SPLM-IO, has resign. Captain Mabio Garan de Mabio says President Salva Kiir's component of the unity government has no intention to implement the revitalized peace agreement.
I can only be part of a unity government if there's real peace, if peace is our roadmap. If there's no agreement being implemented, I don't see myself being able to participate in an honest way in that government.
You said in your letter of resignation that it has become abundantly clear that our partners in peace, meaning the SPLAIG, have no intention of implementing the peace process. What exactly do you mean?
Anybody who has been following the peace process knows that there was a pre-interim period that was supposed to last 8 months, in which the critical task of this pre-transition was, one of them was the security arrangements. This was supposed to be done within 8 months. $100 million was pledged for this. And after 8 months, nothing had been done, and it was extended for 6 months. And after 6 months, nothing was done, and it was extended for another 100 days. And so finally, under pressure, we formed a unity government without security arrangements. So we've had over 2 years of begging the government to implement the agreement, and they are not implementing the agreement.
Did you say in the letter that the international community apply pressure on your organization to implement the peace agreement? And if that is so, which international group forced the SPLM-IO to enter the peace process?
Well, I cannot point a finger at a specific group or say that we were really forced. What I'm saying is that pressure was applied, and this was being done by people who love people of South Sudan. Of course, every country have their interests, but at the end of the day, there are people who are concerned for peace in South Sudan, and they were trying to do everything that they can.
Are you resigning from the SPLM-IO or from the entire government of national unity?
I am not resigning from the SPLM-SPLA-IO as a political movement. It's only the so-called unity government, which I don't believe is doing what it's supposed to be doing. It's not fulfilling its mandate. And so that's why I'm resigning from that.
What do you see as the future of South Sudan, particularly in terms of the peace process? What do you want to tell the people of South Sudan? What hope do you think they can have?
The people of South Sudan, it was through their collective effort that we attained independence. And so my hope, and like the hope of the people of South Sudan, is the people of South Sudan themselves. I have confidence in people power, and this has been demonstrated on several occasions now in our country. And so as the people gain more confidence in themselves, I believe that the people of South Sudan will sort out the situation for themselves.
Captain Mabio, Grand de Mabio, is chairperson of the National Committee for Information and Public Relations of South Sudan's SPLM-IO. You are speaking with us from the capital, Juba. In Guinea, the leader of the opposition Union of Republican Forces Party says it is illegal for the government to change the original text of the constitution recently approved in a referendum. Sidi Touré says significant portions of the original draft of the constitution have been changed, which he says undermines the tenets of democracy. He also says opposition and civil society groups plan to organize a series of nationwide demonstrations to pressure the government to return to the original draft of the constitution.
It's absolutely shameful. Nobody can imagine but one person can change the constitution of the country. They say that they vote for a constitution on 22 of March. You know, we opposition, we war against, because we say we don't have a new constitution, we don't want a new constitution, because that can allow Alpha Conde to have a third mandate. But anyway, if this is a new constitution and people vote on it, the election was really false, but they voted from them. Somebody can, the president, take this constitution and change many articles inside, and now promote this one different from the one people was voting on. This is something absolutely inimaginable, you know. This is what happened. So Guinea are not...
Now, but Mr. Sidi Touré, yes, the government says that nothing has changed from the constitution that was approved by the referendum that Guineans undertook recently, and that nothing has changed. It's the same thing.
No, that's absolutely false. We can give you a two constitution, you can learn it, you know. But two constitutions totally different from many points.
Now, the Guinea Bar Association cited what they call extensive modifications or changes to the original draft. It said many paragraphs had been substantially changed or replaced. Is that your stance too?
Absolutely. In any way, when you have finished to vote on the constitution, nobody can change any word on it. But in this case, they changed many things, you know, relative to a candidate without a party, relative to many things. And Arash Alpha Conde put in the new text and he promoted.
So what are you against in this new draft constitution that President Conde's government has put out.
You know, we're not to recognize this constitution. But what we're saying is a point of law. Somebody cannot sign a constitution by himself. You know, this is what we struggle against. It's not to, we're not concerned about that.
So if you are not concerned about it, what are you going to do now that a lot of people, including the Guinean Bar Association, saying that there have been a lot of changes or modifications to this constitution?
So we'll go to court to say them, but, you know, this cannot be done. And we'll go to ECOWAS too and ask them to intervene and to say that a country cannot have this kind of situation. The constitution is something absolutely used for a country. Nobody can by himself change 2, 3, 11 part of his constitution and say that we are going on all that. But it's just a question of law.
But Mr. Cecilia Ture, what do you say, particularly when the opposition, including your party, say that President Conde is using the judicial system or the court system to have his way? So if you don't trust the system, how do you go to court for the court to rule in your favor?
We'll do it. Maybe we're not going to change. But, you know, for Guinean, we have do our job. We do our job, you know, to say no, that cannot be done. Many NGO, you know, have taken the same way. And all the lawyers here have an association. They say something. They say that's not totally impossible.
Sidi Ature is the leader of the opposition Union of Republican Forces Party in Guinea. He was speaking with VOS Peter Clotty from the capital, Conakry. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with Nigerian forward Odion Ighalo, who says he's open to return to international football with the three-time African champions Nigeria. Odion Ighalo had announced his retirement from international football after the 2019 African Cup of Nations in Egypt. The forward, who only at the start of this week secured a loan extension from Shanghai Shenhua in China with Manchester United, admits that he is buzzing for the resumption of the Premier League after the suspension of the English Premier League as a result of COVID-19.
I'm really happy. It's a dream for me again. So I'm buzzing and ready to go. We are fighting for two cups now, the Europa Cup and the FA Cup, which we want to fight to get to the final and to win it, which is possible, and for us to end in the top four to qualify for Champions League, which has been the aim of the manager, the fans, and everybody in the club till today. This is what we want to achieve, and I'm part of that goal to achieve that. So I'm working towards that with the team and everybody along the club.
Staying with Nigeria, Super Eagles head coach Garrett Rao says he will only pick quality players for the team and declared that it is not part of his contract to pick players who are not good. The 66-year-old was reacting to a clause in his contract which mandates him to ensure that he picks players from the local league. He only last week signed a 2-year contract with the Nigerian Football Federation, and Ross states that he has free hand to pick his players and will only invite players on merit.
Yeah, it's not a part of my contract to take players who are not so good like other one. I can choose my players myself. It is the most important, so nobody can tell me you have to take this one or this one or this one. I can take the best players, and I don't do it alone. We have a team in our staff. I have my assistants, I have my analyzer. Each Monday we have our meeting and we speak about the games of the weekend, what they did our players. So, no, we have to take the best one, no matter where they are coming from.
In Kenya, Football Kenya Federation President Nick Manwanwa has accused Sports Dispute Tribunal of Kenya Chairman John Ohanga of using unorthodox means to kick him out of office. A visibly angry Manwanwa, while addressing the media, also disagreed with Ohanga's decision to nullify FKF's county elections held in March.
That tribunal might have an interest that has not said what it is. In December, he pronounced himself. We followed. In March, on March 17, he pronounced himself. We followed. What is this now? Ohaga is inviting people. A tribunal has become a consultant for FKF election.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. And that is it for this Friday, June 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.